coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Odyssey Charter School is poised to have its charter renewed, but still faces lingering questions about its finances.
The problem is that this term that was used, investigatory audit, doesn't really have a specific definition within the accounting profession. And as a result, what the department got back from the auditors really didn't provide the detail that the Department of Education was looking for.
Contributor Larry Nagengast has more on the status of Odyssey Charter. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about new carbon capture technology being developed at the University of Delaware and get an update on the renovation of the Hotel DuPont's Green Room. And this week's Enlighten Me features work from our Generation Voice Youth Media Program at WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media, our first of 2020. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It's good to be back after our holiday break. Last month, the State Board of Education and Education Secretary Susan Bunting made the final call on charter renewals for five First State charter schools. All five were renewed for another 5 years, but one came with a caveat. That one is Odyssey Charter School, which was placed on probation last year after questions were raised about its management and financial dealings. Some questions still linger surrounding Odyssey, but the ball is not completely in its court to answer them. Contributor Larry Nagengast explains the latest on Odyssey's situation in reporting you can find right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he sat down with me this week to discuss it and some other developing charter school news. Let's talk big picture first. Odyssey gets a five-year renewal if it fulfills terms of its probation, which they were put on last year. Where does the school stand with the majority of those probation terms?
For the most part, the school is in good shape. Keep in mind that the issues here have nothing to do with the school's academic standing. I mean, in terms of curriculum, student performance, Odyssey stands in the upper echelon of the state's charter schools. The issues here relate to the school's management and its spending practices. Now, so as far as the terms of the probation and what the school has done this far, first of all, they've rewritten portions of the school's bylaws, and they're in the process of reorganizing the school's board of directors so that it is no longer automatically controlled by members of the Greek fraternal organization that founded the school and its affiliated groups. Second, they've changed procedures and operating policies for the school's Citizens Budget Oversight Committee to increase transparency and give the school community more access to information about how the board and the school leadership make their financial decisions. Third, they're working on several initiatives to improve communication and build trust with parents, faculty, and the rest of the school community. Some of these items, like periodic town hall meetings, have already begun. Others, like starting a newsletter, are going to take a little bit more time. Now, in all these areas that we've mentioned here, the school should have very little trouble meeting the June 30 deadline for complying with all of the terms of its probation.
But one area remains problematic, and that is the investigatory audit that was ordered. Last month, just before the renewal decision by the state auditor's office delivered results of work done by an outside auditor it hired to look at Odyssey. What, if anything, did that audit reveal?
The audit is the big sticking point here. Now, some of us might remember that last year there were questions raised about some of Odyssey's spending, particularly when it set up an early learning center that would be affiliated with the school, and for two school officials to attend a Greek organization's convention in Atlantic City. So that's what triggered this whole request for an audit. The Department of Education ordered that the school would pay for what it called an investigatory audit that would look at certain groups of financial transactions that were made between 2017 and 2019. Now, the problem here is that this term that was used by the Department of Education, investigatory audit, doesn't really have a specific definition within the accounting profession. And as a result, after all this back and forth, what the department got back from the auditors really didn't provide the level of detail that the Department of Education was looking for.
So as you said, the Department of Education less than satisfied with what was delivered. What specifically are the complaints they have with it, and how is the auditor's office responding to their critique of this audit?
Okay, well, it's not simple, but I'll try to summarize it simply and briefly, okay? The private auditor, the Santora CPA Group, was hired by the state auditor, Kathy McGinnis, to look into Odyssey's spending. Now, Santora's report included, among other things, a list of more than 140 payments that totaled more than $250,000 that Odyssey could not provide documentation to justify. Now, the Department of Education was looking for more than just a list. They wanted the auditors to tell them whether Odyssey did anything wrong in making these payments. Now, McGinnis is saying she's satisfied with Santora's work, that they delivered all that they were asked to do. So now what we have is a little battle brewing between the Department of Education and the auditor, Kathy McGinnis. The department thinks that McGinnis could have been more helpful in making sure that the terms of the contract with Santora would produce what they wanted, and now it wants help from McGinnis's office in interpreting Santora's findings. McGinnis says that her office doesn't have the time or the funding to do any more on this at this time, but it would be willing to help if the Department of Education does desire to pursue this further. Meanwhile, Odyssey is going through its files looking for the missing documentation and promises that it's going to turn over whatever it finds to the Charter Schools Office. But they're not sure when, they hope it's soon, but they're not sure when all these documents will be dug out, and they're not sure how complete the documentation will be when they're finished looking.
So there is still obviously a fair amount of time here before June 30th. Could another audit be done? Will another audit be done?
Possibly, but I mean, Odyssey was ordered to pay for this audit and to produce all the documents that the auditors asked for, and this was done within a tight time frame. The probation letter from the Department of Education was issued in late July, but the audit contract wasn't signed until the first week in October, and there was a deadline of mid-December to get it all done. Now, anyhow, you wouldn't think that after what it did to cooperate that Odyssey would want to pay for another audit. Kathy McGinnis says that the state auditor's office doesn't have the time or the staff to do the work, but it's willing to work with the Department of Education, presumably to arrange another contract, possibly with another auditor, to produce a report that's more like what the department was expecting the first time around. Now, McGinnis isn't saying this, but my guess is that if there is another audit done, she's going to insist that the Department of Education pay for it. Anyhow, presumably within a month or so, Odyssey is going to deliver a stack of receipts and memos to the Department of Education as it attempts to document those 140 or so questionable payments. And somehow, before Odyssey's probation ends on June 30th, the department is going to have to try to figure out whether the school did anything wrong. Right now, they're not sure how they're going to go about doing that.
You mentioned Odyssey is looking for those receipts, trying to fulfill that part of it. Is there anything else that they're saying about this audit or how they're getting their financial house in order?
Josiah Walcott, who's the president of Odyssey's board of directors, said the experience has taught the school that it does need to improve its financial record keeping. Now, when I spoke with him, I didn't go into a great deal of detail about how that's happening, but he did say the school is cleaning up its procedures. It's going to do a better job making sure that future expenses are properly documented, because it really doesn't want this sort of thing to happen again.
In working on this story, you also spent some time looking at what else is on the horizon with charter schools. And in the pipeline are some charter modification requests that are coming up. The biggest one is from one of the state's biggest charters, Newark Charter. What is it looking to do now going forward?
Well, the Newark Charter plan is, it's a really big deal. Newark now has a kindergarten through 12th grade 12 program with an authorized enrollment of about 2,400 students in three buildings on a campus off Elkton Road in the southwest corner of the city of Newark. Now, the school has purchased and rezoned additional land, and it wants to put up a fourth building to house its middle school as part of an expansion plan that would bring total enrollment up to about 3,100 students. The additional students would be spread over all 13 grade levels, and the increase would occur over 4 years, starting in the fall of 2022. Now, Newark Charter has a huge waiting list, so they shouldn't have any trouble filling all these new seats. But you know, in raw numbers, adding nearly 700 students, that amounts to, well, the equivalent of a very large elementary school or a small middle school. And given that the Newark Charter School has an admissions priority that goes to students who are living within a 5-mile radius of its site, means virtually everybody who goes to the school comes out of the Christina School District. So Christina could suffer a fairly significant enrollment bite if this Newark Charter proposal goes through. So it's going to be very interesting to see how all of that plays out.
Two other schools are also looking for modifications to their charters. What are their plans?
Okay. First of all, we've got the Sussex Academy, which had a fairly successful middle and high school program in Georgetown. They want to add an elementary program, putting 240 students in kindergarten through fifth grade. Now, Sussex Academy is working on a deal to take over the site of the Jefferson School, which is a struggling private school a couple miles away in Georgetown, and it would use Jefferson's building to house this new elementary program. Now, because the building is currently being used as a school, if this charter modification request is approved, Sussex Academy would be able to open this elementary program in the fall. The third modification request is far more modest. The Academy of Dover, which now has an authorized enrollment of 300 students in kindergarten through fifth grade, is asking approval to bring back its sixth grade program, and that would result in adding about another 30 more students to the enrollment.
On the new charter front, there is one application in. Where is that?
Well, we don't know a whole lot about this one because the proposal hasn't been posted on the Department of Education's website. The department officials right now are reviewing it, make sure that everything is complete and in order before they post it. But we do know that it's filed by a group from Kent County that wants to open a kindergarten through eighth grade charter school that would be called the Destiny Leadership Academy. And if approved, it could open as early as the fall of 2021.
You also note that there was an application that was expected to be filed but did not materialize. What is the story there?
Okay, well, last summer we talked a bit about the proposed Brian Allen Stevenson School of Excellence, which is a high school plan for the Milton area. And it's timely to mention this now because the school is named for the Milton native who has become a distinguished civil rights attorney and whose memoir, Just Mercy, is also the title of a feature film which just happens to be going into national release this weekend. Anyhow, the school's organizers had originally planned to submit their application this year, but they're still working out the details for site acquisition and for construction. So they've decided to hold off filing the application for another 12 months. Their goal still is to open the school in the fall of 2022. So again, we're going to have to wait a year to see what happens and how all that develops.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. Larry's latest reporting on Odyssey Charter School and other charter news is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with more about new carbon capture technology being developed at the University of Delaware. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A University of Delaware professor has developed new technology that can pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store the greenhouse gas to be used later as a fuel. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino recently spoke with UD's Development Professor of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering, Bingjun Xu, about the invention and its potential large-scale application.
So as I understand it, it was years ago when you first developed this technology that thermochemically splits water molecules, and then it has been recently modified to capture and store carbon dioxide, which is said to be at least part of the cause of global warming. Can you start by telling me the story of how you developed this technology?
The thermochemical water splitting is a technology that I started developing as a postdoctoral researcher at Caltech with my advisor, Mark Davis, and who's also a current collaborator. So at the time, the technology only deals with the water splitting part, that is taking in thermal energy and then split water into hydrogen and oxygen. And then the advantage of that is that we can go from thermal energy directly to chemical energy, that is hydrogen and oxygen. And the source of thermal energy we can leverage will be like the solar thermal, thermal energy from the sun, or from nuclear power plants. And the reason for that is the current way of generating electricity is primarily steam turbines. And because the high pressure, high temperature steam is really corrosive to most of the metals and other materials, the steam turbines typically operate at 650 C. But nuclear power plants, the core could produce like temperatures on the order of like thousands of degrees, so that there's a huge gap that is basically which is cooled down with like cooling water. And it's a kind of a huge wasting energy. And if we can have a technology that is able to take advantage of these higher temperature heat sources, and it will be a potential energy saver, and also it didn't produce any carbon dioxide in the process. So this was the original motivation. And then I finished my postdoc study with Davis, and then I moved to the state of Delaware and then became a faculty here in the chemical engineering department. And then I actually didn't work on this for about 2-3 years before the engineer inside me got the better of me. And then I worked with my graduate student, Casper Brady, who is now a fifth-year graduate student and also in collaboration with Professor Davis at Caltech. And then we designed a integrated reactor that basically takes the same chemistry we developed several years ago, and we can operate all three reactions in the same reactor and then in multiple cycles. And also, the final twist is that we also developed a way that we can integrate this thermochemical water splitting scheme with the air capture of CO2. Basically, that is, we can take the CO2 from the air and use this process to concentrate it, in a sense that we can store the concentrated CO2. And then this is one of the few methods that is able to really take, to remove very dilute concentration of CO2 in the air. And here I would like to clarify that I mentioned that the CO2 level in the air is very dilute. So whether the concentration of CO2 is dilute or high is actually a kind of subjective or relative term, because the current CO2 level is about 410 ppm, which is considered to be very, very concentrated in the air by historical numbers, levels. But at the same time, as a chemical engineer, a gas component that is about 400 ppm is considered to be very dilute. So there's no conflict here. And then in the more recent paper published in 2019, and then we basically reported this finding and then also described the potential applications of this technology, that this reactor that is able to efficiently take advantage of the thermal energy input, either from the solar or from other sources, and we can split water into hydrogen and oxygen at the same time without impacting on its efficiency of the cycle. We can remove CO2 from the air and then concentrate it. And then what we can achieve is about, we can input the CO2 in the air from, let's say, on the campus of University of Delaware, which is about 400 ppm, and then we can reduce it down to about 100 ppm of CO2. So this is something that we demonstrated in our recent publication.
I definitely want to get into some of the applications, as you mentioned. So if I understand the technology correctly, not only is it able to more efficiently split water thermochemically than previous technology was able to, but now it's also able to pull CO2 out of the air and contain it for future use. And all powered, as you said, potentially by the sun, which sounds pretty efficient. Would this technology be able to be used on a large scale level, as they have in some factories, I believe in Texas, where they're able to power several hundred homes without emitting any carbon because they're using this carbon capture technology? Is your technology scalable on that level?
Yes. So the reactor we developed is basically self-sufficient, and in the sense that it takes thermal energy and is able to basically generate the airflow and put air in and then remove CO2 and at the same time produce water and produce hydrogen and oxygen. And the demonstration unit we have is relatively small, and we haven't duplicated this reactor yet, but potentially there's no real technical challenge in terms of just repeating the same unit and then making it more automated and then scale it up.
So then would this be a potential solution, or at least a way to mitigate the saturation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
I would say this could be a good contributor to that goal, because just the scale of the atmospheric CO2 reduction is just too huge, and it's very unlikely for one single technology to make a dominant contribution, and we need all kinds of contributions, or just techniques or technology to accomplish that. And I foresee the potential of the technology we developed, that at least it could, in some cases, for example, at places with abundant thermal energy, and then this could operate relatively economically. And then we actually did a techno-economic analysis in our publication demonstrating the potential that this technology could be competitive compared with the existing ones.
So then what's next for your technology? You've demonstrated that it's able to work on the small scale. Is this something that could be used by power plants or other facilities that are emitting carbon dioxide?
Yes. So in a sense that this technology is able to take a very dilute CO2 source and then concentrate the CO2. And then concentrating CO2 is always energetically easier when you have a more concentrated source. For example, that in the air, we have about 400 ppm of CO2. And at the exhaust of a power plant, let's say the thermal power plant, and then the concentration of CO2 could be on the order of 10% or even higher. So that in that case, we could use this technology to concentrate the CO2 in the exhaust and then make it almost pure CO2. And then for other applications or for storage, right? So this is something that could potentially be coupled with other more concentrated point sources of CO2.
And are there conversations at this time to that end to implement this technology on a larger scale?
So this is something that we haven't started yet, and we have been concentrating on focusing on the development of this reactor, and we believe this is a core technology that could enable scale up or scale out. By scaling out, what I meant is that it just make it more really modular so that it can be deployed in many places rather than building a, let's say, large-scale chemical plant.
Thanks to UD's chemical and biomolecular engineering professor, Bingzheng Xu, and our Nick Shalino for joining us on The Green this week. And there's more to come, including an update on planned renovations to the Hotel DuPont's Green Room. Stick around for that next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. if you want to dine at the iconic Green Room in Wilmington's Hotel DuPont and thought you missed the opportunity before it closed, well, you have a brief reprieve. We told you last fall the restaurant is set to undergo major renovations and would close for several months starting January 1st. Well, that closing date has been pushed back a couple of weeks to give diners a little more time. The Buccini Poland Group now owns the Hotel DuPont and is behind this reimagining of the Green Room. And Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele recently spoke with Buccini Poland co-founder and president Dave Poland to get a project update. And with the new chef coming in, Tyler Aiken, who intends to create a new French-themed restaurant.
We have had a number of different organizations ask for us to keep the restaurant open for a few more days. It looks like we'll stay open through January 17th to accommodate people's hopes of getting in for one more Green Room experience.
That's fantastic. Hey, did you have a lot of crowds over the Christmas and New Year holidays?
Yeah, we really did. We really did. And we were so pleased to see old friends and, you know, people even experiencing for the first time, because a lot of people, whether in Wilmington or from the surrounding areas or even from places like Baltimore and Washington, had heard of the Green Room and had always meant to get there, but they never had the opportunity. So this kind of forced their hand, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but they said, hey, there's a small window that we can still go to this, you know, incredible, iconic place and have this really unique experience. And so we saw some new visitors as well.
All right, so set the scene for people who are not aware of the Hotel DuPont's Green Room. Tell us what it's all about, and tell us about the big changes that are coming this year.
You bet. So the Hotel DuPont is a 1913 vintage Grand Dame hotel. It's a four-diamond, beautiful center of the community in Wilmington, Delaware, right on Rodney Square. And the Green Room has been in its current configuration for about 16 years. And what I mean by that is whether it's the carpet or the seating or the window treatments, but the room itself has been in place, you know, since the beginning. So beautiful historic elements like a hand-painted Italian stucco ceiling, beautiful chandeliers that were handcrafted in France, you know, amazing large windows overlooking Rodney Square, just, you know, really iconic elements to it, big volume space. So kind of something that would be almost impossible to build today. And what we found over the past year or so, and, you know, that's through our stewardship of the hotel, which has actually been more like 2 years. I misspoke there. The usage of it has been declining. And while people really enjoyed the Green Room and like to come back for special occasions, that's really what it was, a special occasion restaurant. And today, the world's different. People dine. They don't have as much time. They can't do an hour and a half for lunch necessarily. Many people are eating lighter, and they don't want to have, you know, heavy sauces and buttercreams and those kinds of things. So the restaurant had to evolve along with the dining tastes of today, as well as the community. The community has changed in Wilmington from, hey, it's just bankers and lawyers downtown. Now there's the creative class. You have places like The Mill where you have graphic designers and engineers and people working in fintech, and maybe they don't want to wear a suit to lunch or to dinner. And if they want to take their spouse or a friend out for a beer, maybe the Green Room didn't feel like the right fit. So what we're doing is we're keeping all those really cool elements that I described that make the Green Room special, and we're bringing in a talented new chef, Tyler Aiken. He's got several restaurants in Philly, but he's from Wilmington, and he grew up dining in the Green Room with his grandparents and going to those special occasions I mentioned. So Tyler's reimagined the Green Room as a really special French bistro. It'll have a lot of modern interpretation of that kind of fare. And it'll also have the classics. So people can still go and have that, you know, great family meal and celebration, but they can also come in for something lighter and something more modern. The space will look similar to what it is today, but we're bringing in more comfortable seating, different kinds of seating, some fresher new finishes and lighting. And I think people will really, if they love the Green Room, they'll find a lot to still like. And if it wasn't their style and taste, I think they'll find something maybe a little more casual and a little more appropriate for today's habits.
Yeah, and Dave, I want to mention here that we're going to be talking to Chef Tyler momentarily. Tyler's going to be creating basically a new French concept. The Green Room name is being tossed. Do we know what the new name is? Can you tell us?
You're going to have to give me about another week. And I apologize for that. We're not trying to be coy, and we're releasing information as quickly as we can, i.e. our chef and our concept and the fact that it's changing and the dates. But with a name change, you have things like trademark, and we have a community that we want to make sure is being fully consulted, including our board of advisors. So you'll have to just give us a few more days for the new name.
All right, one last question for you. Dave Polin from the Buccini Polin Group. Once the restaurant finally closes in January 17th, how soon before it reopens under the new name and with this new French concept?
We are hoping for the end of April. And as I mentioned, when we go into a really special space like that, we don't go in with jackhammers and sledgehammers. We go in very carefully, and we're going to be, again, preserving what's really special. So if we don't find any surprises, and we don't anticipate finding many, then because we've done so many surveys and we've taken real good care to be protective of what makes it special, we'll be open in April. Probably towards the end of that month. We feel like being open for Mother's Day would be a great way to introduce ourselves back to the community.
All right, so now we want to talk to the brand new chef of the new green room at the Hotel DuPont, Tyler Aiken. Before we talk about what you have planned for the new green room, I know the name is changing, but before we talk about that, give me some background about yourself.
So I'm actually from Wilmington. I grew up there from the time I was born. Moved down to D.C. where I began cooking, attended culinary school, and after being down there for about 5 years, moved to Philadelphia to take a job at the Hav. Spent a couple of years there before breaking off and opening my first restaurant, which is called Stock and is in the Fishtown neighborhood of Philly.
All right, so January 17th, the Hotel DuPont's iconic green room is going to shut down. The dining room is closing. It'll reopen in April under a new name. You will be the brand new chef. Talk to me about some plans you may have.
Yeah, so we spent a lot of time out at Hagley looking through the archives of what the green room has been over the years and tried to use a little bit of what we gleaned from that research to inform the decision about what it would ultimately become. We found that at various periods in various different ways, it was basically a French restaurant that just manifested differently throughout the years. It really made sense to us just based on the grandeur of the space and kind of the aesthetic and the history of what the cuisine actually has been there to kind of pay homage a bit and not have it be a drastic break conceptually. So we still are looking to French cuisine, kind of new school French brasserie style foods. And we're going to be looking to the south of France and the north of Africa for influences on that menu.
I have to ask this because they were so popular. The Green Room is pretty famous for its signature almond macaroons. Will you be serving the macaroons when you reopen?
Yeah, they will be present in some shape or form. I think that we would be crazy to take them away from the people. They're so beloved that they're not going anywhere.
Chef Tyler, what does this mean for you, this whole experience, being brought in to lead this new restaurant at the Hotel DuPont?
It's such a meaningful project to me. This restaurant was truly important, in my view, growing up, just as a member of the Wilmington community and a member of a family that, had the privilege of going there to eat from time to time. Everybody has always spoken of the green room in such hallowed terms as kind of the pinnacle of dining in Delaware and even in the region at certain times in its history. So to me, it's such an honor. Really a challenging project in terms of scope and all of the little things we need to pay attention to, whether it's the architectural details or community input. It's really been a joy, and I can't speak highly enough of PM Hotel Group and Buccini Polin Group and, how committed they are to doing this right.
Any final words to Delaware residents and people beyond who may visit the new restaurant in the Hotel DuPont come April?
Yeah, I think people are going to be really pleased to see that we have maintained the integrity and the bones of the space. I've seen some comments online. People are worried that we're going to be gutting it, and the soul of this restaurant is going to be lost. Yes, it is a new restaurant, but I think we are going to match how special the Green Room was in every way, and I look forward to showing people that.
Thanks to Puccini Pollen Group co-founder and president Dave Pollen, Chef Tyler Aiken, and our Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. We close out the show with Enlighten Me and a sample of student work from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project at Mount Pleasant High School's WMPH. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In our latest Enlighten Me, we head to WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, one of the two schools we partner with on our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. Students there and at our other partner, WMHS, at McCain High School in the Red Clay School District, produce a bevy of interviews and projects on a variety of topics throughout the school year. And this week, we bring you a few examples of student work from the fall at WMPH. Up first is an in-depth piece from junior Jade Reyes, who delved into abductions and kidnappings in an effort to demystify these crimes and the way they're investigated.
Hi, I'm Jade from WMPH News, and I want to bring you some behind-the-scenes information about kidnappings and their patterns and how they're investigated. When I was first asked to think about issues that are important to the community, I thought about Amber Alerts and the abductions that causes the Amber Alerts to be sent out in the media and social media. I wanted to know more about people taking other people. What kind of person does that kind of thing and why? Dr. Richard Card is a director of Wilmington University's Crime Justice Institution. He helps us get clear about the meanings of different words.
Well, first of all, there's a big difference between abductions and kidnappings. People have a tendency to place both in the same category. And they're not. When you kidnap someone, it's usually you're taking a person by force, threat, or deceit, and you intend to cause harm to that person or detain them against their will. If a person is abducted, it's usually criminal in nature, and a person is usually taken based upon the offender's persuasion or by defrauding the person or by open force or violence.
According to Wilmington's private detective Tom Monahan, there is a pattern who commits these offenses.
Child kidnappings, most of them are actually parental kidnappings, where the non-custodial parent, who has been deemed by the court not to be a fit parent, takes the child and attempts to flee the jurisdiction.
Richard Carr contracts different types of kidnapped victims.
Then you have acquaintance kidnapping, which involves a high percentage of juvenile individuals. And the largest percentage of those are also female victims. Then you have stranger kidnappings, which females are victimized more than males, and they primarily occur at outdoor locations. And it victimizes both teenagers and school-aged children. And a lot of times in stranger kidnapping, that's when you have sexual assaults that are associated with that type of offense. About one child out of every 10,000 that are reported missing is not found alive. 20% of the children reported to the National Center for the Missing and Exploited Children in non-family abductions were not found alive in 2010. About 80% of the abductions by strangers, the first contact between the child and the abductor occurs very, very close to where the child lives. A lot of potential abductors are going to grab their victims off the street or try and lure them into their vehicles. approximately 75% of those victims are usually girls.
This shows kidnapping can happen in many different situations. Tom Monahan says that the police officers also have a system called the Uniform Crime Reports, where they go around their patrol areas and see if something is out of place, and if so, they report it to their district. He also says that there is a standard procedure of how a missing person report gets processed.
When someone's reported missing, you know, they're typically reported, they'll get the 911 call. Goes to the communication center, whatever police agency is handling it. Depending on the severity of the case, so at least a uniform officer is typically dispatched to take the report. That officer will make a determination based on the circumstances whether a follow-up is needed, and detectives should be called as well.
Monahan says that reports are categorized one of two ways.
An endangered missing person or a non-endangered missing person. You know, in the first scenario I described, that's like a non-endangered, you know, the person's basically just run away. You don't have any reason to believe that they're in harm. Where the second one is, you know, it's a small juvenile that's disappeared who obviously can't make a decision for themselves, or you have an adult who in some way is impaired, either mentally or physically. That's more of an urgent matter.
Another type of alert for missing people is the Amber Alert for children. Here's Richard Carr.
The primary thing is the child must be at risk of serious injury or death. And there has to be enough descriptive information of the child, the offender, the offender's vehicle, to be able to issue the alert. And it has to be under 18 years of age.
Carr says these alerts are important because finding the children quickly increases their chances of being found.
It's well known that the longer the time period is that a child is abducted and not found, the less of a chance of finding the child or the victim alive. So that's really concerning, and that's where the Amber Alert really comes from.
Do investigators ever decide to close a case? Here's Tom Monahan.
What they'll do is they'll suspend it, but they don't close it. In other words, it's suspended pending further leads. It's always done by a team, but it's not actually closed out. It's just there's no active leads to follow up, and you basically at that point they're just waiting for something else to break. So if, say, 2 years after it's suspended, somebody calls in and says, hey, I just saw this missing child, you know, the case is immediately reactivated.
This public affairs show is about how any person of any age can put on a facade or a mask of being a true friend of a family friend to be an exact threat towards you and your safety. This also shows that you can live your life with a little less worrying since you know the tips and aspects of how the situation may occur. I am Jade from WMPH News.
And I'm Sophia Schmidt, the youth media producer at Mount Pleasant from Delaware Public Media. Jade also interviewed local advocate Sharia Schotz, who works to raise awareness about safety and abuse. Schotz says one technique parents can use to keep their children safe is establishing what she calls code words.
And this is teaching your children a specific word to say that only you and your child knows. It might be green tomatoes. It might be yellow grapes. It might be anything. So you tell them that code word. So if that person comes to get them and they're not familiar with that person, but he say, oh, well, your mommy sent me, and say, what's the code word?
Schotz says people can also protect themselves when they feel they're being followed by looking the stalker in the eyes.
They fear being known, being found out. So that's why you look them right in their face and let them know, oh, I know who you are. I can tell, and look for a distinguishing mark.
This has been a public affairs report by WMPH staffer Jade. And I'm Sophia Schmidt from Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to Mount Pleasant Junior Jade Reyes and our Sophia Schmidt for producing that piece. Next, we have another Mount Pleasant Junior, Liam Utes, who took a look at the so-called Centerville trash bomber. That's drawn complaints from Centerville residents.
My name is Liam, and as you know, we take our commitment to public service very seriously. As an example of our service, we investigated reports of a littering problem in Centerville. According to WDEL, over the past couple of years, trash has been dumped up and down in Centerville on Route 52. People have been attempting to catch the culprit, who they assume to be a single person who they refer to as the trash bomber. Here's Tim Furlong, one of the reporters who had worked on this story that appeared on WDEL in October.
Neighbors over the last few years have been messaging me on Facebook and texting me and basically telling me that somebody, basically they believe it's one person, and some people believe it's 100% guaranteed it's a woman based on some of the trash they found. They believe that somebody goes by and for whatever reason, whether they have an axe to grind against Centerville, which is a wealthier community, they don't know why exactly, but somebody throws their trash at different spots along Route 52 Kennett Pike.
Delaware State Police has been investigating these incidents as they've been happening. Master Corporal Michael Austin said in an email that these incidents were investigated individually, but with awareness of what had occurred in the past. As of late October, they had not identified a suspect. Here's Tim Furlong.
Imagine if this is your neighborhood. It's just over and over and over again. I mean, they come out, sometimes it goes for like once a week, sometimes it's twice a week, and then it'll go for a couple months and not happen. So every time they think they're getting close to getting an answer, they're stifled. And so I feel bad for these people because it would just be maddening to have this happen. So I think it's just very frustrating, and I feel their frustration for sure.
A public Facebook group named Catch the Trash Bomb was created in 2015, and it currently has more than 140 members. Posts include progress in the apprehension of the trash bomber, as well as images and details of the litter they had found scattered around, including envelopes, bottles, and at least four times, according to the page admin, Kelly Collins McDowell, dead goats, and bloody clothes. There's also been a GoFundMe created by one of the Facebook group admins, George Hobbs, in order to catch this trash bomber. They plan to use the funds from the GoFundMe to invest in technologies that can be used in order to apprehend the trash bomber. The fundraiser has currently raised over $1,200. According to Delaware law, someone found guilty of littering can be fined at least $50 and 8 hours of community service, and if they do it again within 2 years of the first offense, they could be fined $75 and at least 25 hours of community service. But also, if a person is found guilty of dumping, which is just littering but in a much more substantial quantity, they could be fined up to $500 and serve 8 hours of community service. And if they do it again within 2 years of the previous offense, they could be fined up to $1,000 and spend 16 hours of community service. The identity of the trash bomber is still unknown, and that person is still at large. I'm Liam for WMPH News.
Thanks to Mount Pleasant Jr. Liam Utes for his piece. A reminder that stories like these are part of Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH, and the Red Clay School District at McCain High School and its radio station WMHS. Our youth media producer, Sophia Schmidt, oversees Generation Voice for us and works on pieces like these with teacher Paul Wishengrad, who runs the career pathway we work with at Mount Pleasant High School. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, Mount Pleasant High School students Jade Reyes and Liam Utes, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.